This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. I'm excited today to be joined by Barry Friedberg. Dr. Friedberg was way out in front in sort of opioid sparing anesthesia. We're going to talk about that and just talk about healthcare in general, as there's so many things going on right now. Dr. Friedberg, can you take a moment and introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm a board certified anesthesiologist who's been giving opioid free anesthesia since 1992. And I pioneered the use of a brain monitor in 1997, making the technique far more reproducible, more science than art. Along the way, my textbook was published by Cambridge University Press, Anesthesia and Cosmetic Surgery, back in 07, and it was translated into Portuguese 2 years later, and 5 years ago into Mandarin Chinese. And along the way, I received a U.S. Congressional Award for my propofol ketamine technique being adopted by the U.S. military for use in advanced units, so they didn't need anesthesia machines and H tanks of oxygen.
That's fantastic. Let me ask you a question. Easier for you to read your textbook in Mandarin, in Portuguese, or in English?
It depends on what country you're from.
Right.
When they told me Portuguese, I said, "Why Portuguese?" And they said, Barry, Brazil, cosmetic surgery, Brazil, they speak Portuguese there. Oh, okay. Many of my friends in the Spanish-speaking world were somewhat offended that the book was not translated into Spanish.
Well, fantastic. And for them, it depends what country they're in. For you, I assume it's easy for you to proof it in any of those languages and not a problem.
Well, it turns out that one of my colleagues was a Mandarin speaker who was able to proof those chapters to make sure, because he was a big believer in the anesthetic technique that I involved. So, yes, it was easy for me to proof in English, and the Portuguese we had to let go because I didn't have any Portuguese speakers to check it out.
Right. Not even a Portuguese water dog, and just sort of went with it and we'll hope that it's okay. It's good.
Exactly.
Tell me how you got started in this focus of anesthesia sparing, you know, opioid sparing anesthesia. You were way ahead of your time. Obviously now you're a genius. How did you get started on this path? What made you go down this path and get people thinking this way?
Tragedy. In 1990, an otherwise healthy 34-year-old woman had a breast augmentation surgery in her plastic surgeon's office and died secondary to fentanyl overdose. And so when I knew the surgeon from working with him at the hospital, and when I approached him, he said, "That's great. We'd like to have you give anesthesia in our office. You can use any drugs you like, but no narcotics." So as luck would have it, I happened to go to a lecture by a plastic surgeon who was giving Valium, diazepam, and ketamine. And he didn't really stress the opioid-free aspect of it. He just said, "This is something that works really well." And so when I went up to see him, I said, the idea of using ketamine to make patients lie still for local anesthetics seemed intriguing, but Valium seemed like a very improbable drug to use for outpatient day surgery cases. So I suggested using propofol, and he said, "Well, the only reason you want to use that is it's expensive." But I persisted in the early 1990s. I just replaced his Valium with my propofol and ran with the ketamine. It took me a while to refine the dose. And as I say, after that, everything was history. But the really thing that really surprised me was in the first 15 years before this period of time when I'd given anesthesia, it never crossed my mind, why did I have to give patients opioids or narcotics for pain after surgery? Well, it's pretty obvious, isn't it, that surgery is painful. And then I saw 25 consecutive propofol ketamine patients wake up, and they didn't need any narcotics, and they weren't sick to their stomach, which are the two main problems after anesthesia. And it was the OMG WTF moment in my career, because it occurred to me that the reason that people have pain after surgery is they're having pain during surgery, which is the whole reason I thought I was standing in the operating room to prevent that from happening. So it was an earth-shaking moment, and I became determined to publish and advocate this technique as far and wide as possible.
Fascinating. And tell me, you've had this great practice forever. You do fascinating writing and teaching. What are you most excited about today? What excites you today about what you do and what you see? What's exciting to you today?
Well, trying to make a contribution to stemming the next generation of post-surgery related opioid addicts. When you use opioid-free anesthesia, not only don't you get narcotics during the surgery, but the need for narcotic pain relief is dramatically reduced and oftentimes completely eliminated. You can get by with non-steroidals or acetaminophen. The tremendous idea is getting rid of the next generation of opioid addicts.
No, that's fine. And obviously the opioid crisis, the fentanyl issues, just a huge scourge in our country. Is that starting to get better now?
Well, it's hard for me to say because I'm not really involved in addiction treatment, but it appears that at least for the time being, my work has gotten a lot more attention than it formerly got. Now, the downside is, yes, I've been doing opioid-free, but no, I don't use anesthesia for traditional hospital-based surgery. And I try to emphasize the fact that the technique works very, very well for any surgical procedure that involves going through the skin. So in other words, endoscopic procedures, maybe not so important, but anytime you're punching holes or cutting incisions in patients, the idea of using ketamine before incision so the brain is completely fooled is very, very valid. Sometimes a little difficult to get colleagues to appreciate that, but I keep trying because the more feedback I get, the more I feel like the Johnny Appleseed of anesthesia instead of the Don Quixote.
And when you look at other medical pioneers, who else do you look at and say, whether in your field or not, you say, that person is really making a contribution. I'm impressed with what that person's doing.
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because there are two great pioneers in medicine. One was Virchow, and the other was Harvey Cushing, the father of modern neurosurgery. And they both had what they call their triads, the three statements that symbolize or embody their work. And in that vein, my triad is what I hope people will remember me in the perpetuity, which is very simply to measure the brain, to preempt the pain, and emetic drugs abstain. Emesis, of course, is the medical word for throwing up.
Fascinating. So triage. Repeat the triage for us, the three core statements. Repeat that for us for the audience.
Sure. Measure the brain, preempt the pain, emetic drugs abstain.
And I don't know if in your world you're doing lots of elective or non-elective surgery, what you're doing today, but a question about elective surgery, either way, will the universe of elective surgery slow down significantly right now with this coronavirus situation going on?
I suspect many people will be deferring their elective surgery until things settle down. I don't really have any firm public health data on it, but just like you see the shopping malls are slowing down and the movie theaters are empty and the Disneyland and Disney World is shutting down, that people who don't have to have surgery are going to most likely defer it.
When you look at advice for other healthcare professionals, for leaders, what advice do you have for other leaders, other healthcare professionals? And I want to talk about your having this magnificent, straddled career where you've been a doctor, a writer, a thinker, an educator. And I want to ask you, maybe I'll say that question first. How important is that mix of roles to keeping your profession interesting and fending off what everybody talks about, this burnout and all those kinds of things? How important has been that mix of things that you do to keeping professional life exciting and challenging and interesting and not boring?
Right. Well, boredom is the main advocacy situation for me. It began in the late 1990s with the introduction of the brain monitor. As Lord Kelvin famously said, if you cannot measure it, you cannot improve it. We talk a great deal about patient-to-patient variability and how they respond to medication, but when you measure, go slowly, and measure the effect, there are no outliers anymore. So that's what really has kept it very interesting. Typically, what happens in anesthesia is you develop a clinical sixth sense when you size up a patient preoperatively as to how much medication you think they're going to require based on factors that really have nothing to do with what's going on above their eyebrows, you know, their body weight, their heart rate and blood pressure changes. But once you start measuring, you see, giving the anesthetic becomes like an open book test. And it shows you how limited clinical guesses are compared to measuring.
It's so true. When you look at things like imaging today, compared to 30 years ago when a surgeon did things by guesswork, tried to diagnose what was going on with an elbow or something else or an arm or whatever it might be or a knee or whatever it is. The idea of doing this without imaging and x-rays today and not having a real picture, but just doing it by feel and guess, right, seems so primitive now.
Well, again, as you talk about imaging, you know, in my early days when we were seeking paresthesias to try to place a nerve block, today we have the imaging of ultrasound to make a very precise placement of the local anesthetic and dramatically improve not only the quality of the pain relief, but the minimize the discomfort to the patient placing it. Paresthesia is the sensation people get when they bang their funny bone, their elbow. And it's not a nice thing to be poking around to get that to decide when to put the local anesthesia. So ultrasound-guided regional anesthesia has been a tremendous advance in pain relief for surgery.
Fascinating. So what advice do you have for other physicians trying to have great careers where they'll thrive and they'll love it? And the same thing for really any profession. What advice do you have for others?
Try to stay interested. And try, if you don't have brain monitoring available, to get it, because it really, it's incredible. I mean, I often say, look, you would never give a blood pressure medication without measuring the blood pressure. Here on a daily basis, we're giving medications which have dramatic impacts on patients' brains, and the technology to directly measure it has been available since 1996. It's available in most hospitals, and yet it's only used 20% of the time because the leaders in the national organizations have been very slow to encourage adopting brain monitoring as the 21st century standard of care for major surgery under anesthesia.
Fascinating. A different question. There's all the talk today about robotic surgery and where that's going. Can you give us an inkling of what your sense is of how important this will become or not? And the reason I talk about it, similar to what you're talking about, and there's all this equipment available, but only 20% are using it. Where do you see this robotic surgery going or digital assisted surgery going?
Well, I imagine it's going to have a growth curve. I can't really speak to it because it's really outside my area of clinical experience. But there are naysayers who say, well, there's really no convincing data that shows you it's really better than a skilled surgeon. And I would imagine, like all technology, it's going to continue to grow.
Well, thank you. And it's such an interesting perspective. You know, you're unlike some of our guests, whether they know something or not, they want to talk about it. So I appreciate you holding off on that, and not talking if you don't have that real deep thoughts on it. I appreciate that very much. When you look at priorities for the U.S. health system, any thoughts, any solutions on how you improve healthcare in our country? Overall, a great system, imperfect, but trying to serve 325 million plus people. You know, when you look at the countries that are larger, in my own perspective, they're doing a much poorer job of it. For sure, there's countries that are smaller, they're doing a better job. But how do you improve overall good system that, you know, is constantly needs to improve on access and quality and cost? What improvements do you make in the U.S. healthcare system?
Well, I will tell you this. There is an epidemic of anesthesia over medication for failing to have direct measurement of brain activity response to anesthesia. In 2009, the first mortality study was published. I originally focused on the one anesthesia over medication death every day. But it's really hard when there's only 365 deaths a year out of 40 million patients to get overly worked up, unless one of those deaths happens to be, you know, a parent, a dearly loved parent or spouse or child. The real issue is that 40% of patients, and as that was recorded, it was like 16 million patients every year emerge with postoperative brain fog. They call it by different terms. They call it postoperative cognitive dysfunction, disorder, delirium. That's a huge number of patients that most likely don't have to happen for lack of brain monitoring. So my nonprofit, my self-funded nonprofit, Goldilocks Anesthesia Foundation, has been dedicated to promoting this idea for the general welfare. I think that would make an enormous difference. Now, along that line, I wrote a book for the general public that they can download a free e-copy from the website. The book is called Getting Over, Going Under, Five Things You Must Know Before Anesthesia. It's very hard when patients approach surgery. They're primarily focused on the body part that needs fixing. It's very hard to move beyond that to say, well, what about the anesthesia? So the Goldilocks Anesthesia Foundation exists to help promote this idea because it's not being done by any national organizations. In addition, I would say that since 2010, when I wrote and published the book, I've given away more than 7,500 hard copies of the book. So when people say, you know, what's your story? Do you have any skin in the game? I'd say, well, yeah, I've got some serious skin in the game. I believe that it's the right thing to promote. And I think that when you talk now, the numbers are 50 million patients a year. So we're talking about 20 million patients waking up with postoperative brain fog. Now, the reality is for many patients, the overwhelming majority, that fog lifts in hours or days or weeks, but it goes past a year. Not only are you stuck with it, there's no fixing it. So it's a serious national health problem that nobody's talking about aside from my foundation. I will also say the reason it's called the Goldilocks Anesthesia Foundation is that the number that comes off the patient's forehead means that patients can't get too much or too little, only just the right or Goldilocks amount. It's a restatement of what the Greeks carved in stone many thousands of years ago, which said all things in moderation, nothing in excess. And when you go under anesthesia for major surgery, it's a guarantee of being over-medicated if the person who's giving that anesthetic isn't using a brain monitor.
Right. So you've done this magnificent job in one podcast of tying together the Daily Stoic, or the concept of stoicism, of not too little, not too much, everything in moderation, plus Goldilocks, not too hot, not too cold, just right, in sort of the moderate right temperature. And I should give you some kind of award or some kind of bonus or something, because we've nobody had tie those two concepts together of moderation from the Stoics and moderation from Goldilocks.
Correct. Thank you.
You're welcome. And so, Dr. Freeberg, last question is, how do people learn more about you and what you do or the Goldilocks Foundation? I just a pleasure talking to you and learning about what you do and your depth of concern and knowledge and compassion here and deep thought, textbook printed in multiple different languages. Amazing. How do people learn more about you and what you do in the Goldilocks Foundation?
Well, they can go to GoldilocksFoundation.org and read extensive amounts of press releases, publications. I have a YouTube channel. They can see my videos on opioid-free anesthesia. I'm active in social media on LinkedIn. So that's pretty much it. I'm out there working every day to help people understand that they can do better and that relies on measuring. And that's pretty much the story. I think that I think there's even a Goldilocks Foundation page on Facebook as well. I do tweet.
Yeah, no, a magnificent thing. And, you tweet too less, too little, but if you tweeted too much, it'd be a problem. So we got to get you to tweet just the right amount, like everything else.
Exactly. A Goldilocks tweet.
The Goldilocks and the Stoicism tweet. Exactly. Just fantastic. Dr. Freeberg, a pleasure visiting with you. What a bright guy and what a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today. What a pleasure.
Well, thank you for having me. It was fun to listen to the questions and try my best to give you a decent answer when I had something to say.
No, you were fantastic. Fantastic. Thank you, sir.